This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. Government actions meeting business decisions online at www.bgov.com and on the air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Another congressional recess is right around the corner. With their next 30-day run, what will they attempt to accomplish sometime in July? Our man on the Hill, congressional analyst Lauren Duggan, will join us to discuss. We'll have energy analyst Allison Williams and economic analyst Jason Arvello joining us shortly to discuss part two of a three-part series focusing on the economics of federal oil and gas leases. We'll talk about trends they may have identified and the big players in that space as well. But we'll kick things off today with someone who is no stranger to Capital Impact. Sopin Shah is a defense finance analyst with Bloomberg Government who's taken a look at the federal contractor space with a private eye. Sopin, thanks for joining me.
Excited to be here, as always.
Did you like the private eye part?
That was good.
That's good, because we're talking private equity, correct?
We are.
Your latest Bloomberg Government Insight is entitled Private Equity, Active in Federal Market, kind of providing a look at the top five equity firms holding federal contractors and how much money, contracts that is, and how much money that represents. So that lends itself to a couple of obvious questions. Number one, why did you do this? and number two, with regard to the pool from which this was all drawn, how did you define the private equity firms included on the list? Like, what was your criteria?
Sure. So to your first question, we did this because private equity has been an increasing player in the government contracting or federal market over the past few years. And we saw a pretty sharp uptick in the number of private equity or private equity-backed investments. From 2005, the number was around 14, and it jumped to 72 in 2007. And if you look at the numbers since that point, private equity has remained pretty active, and they still are today.
So looking back historically, this is, I mean, since the numbers began to spike, it's really nothing new. Private equity has been involved in government contracting for quite some time. It's just we're looking now at a dollar value, shall you say, or something like that, that now has pushed them up to the forefront?
Well, they have been involved for the past few years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're not new in the sense that they've just started investing in 2011 and 2012. But we've seen some trends in what they're investing in, right, and the specific companies that they've chosen. So in my insight, we talk about the Carlyle Group, who holds Booz Allen Hamilton. We talk about Cerberus Capital Management, who owns DynCorp, Providence Equity Partners, they own SRA International, and Court Square Capital Partners, and they own Wiley Laboratories Incorporated. And so these actors have been pretty active in the space for the past few years, but there are some trends, you know, in government spending that we've talked about a lot on previous shows in terms of budget austerity that may impact their involvement going forward.
So let's talk about that. As the budget is now being slashed, so to speak, what is the impact on these companies? I mean, I'm looking at the Carlyle Group, who holds ARINC, ranked 134th in the BGov 200, the ranking, of course, that we did not too long ago. How is that going to impact their standing?
We think that it's less likely that new private equity firms that aren't on the list, that aren't in the insight, will enter the federal contracting market today when we compare it to a few years ago. And without significant projected growth in federal spending or government spending, it's going to be hard for PE firms that aren't already familiar with the market to justify entering. However, it's possible that current private equity players who are already familiar with the market will increase their involvement as some of the valuations on the price expectations of some federal contractors who may not be in growing federal markets drop over the next couple of years.
Let's shift gears slightly and talk a little bit about MAC. As we take a look at these private equity firms, is there any merger and acquisition opportunity out there. Do you see that on the forefront, or looking into your SOPIN's crystal ball, do you see private equity firms deciding to acquire each other because of the contracts that the defense contractors that they hold may have?
I don't think we anticipate that type of activity. Mm-hmm. We probably will see more of a private equity firm investing in a contractor, as we've seen for the past few years.
Okay. Cerebras, a company that owns IAP Worldwide, Facilities Management and Transportation Services Company, number 108, a lot of money that they're pulling in from the Pentagon, $554.7 million. We're not talking about little pieces of change here. This is a lot of money that private equity firms now have a stake in.
Definitely. Our insight shows that the federal contractors held by Carlyle and Cerberus, as you mentioned, got over four.
Cerberus. What did I say? Cerebus? Cerberus. Thank you.
It's the name of a mythical dog, I believe.
Okay.
So that's where the name comes from.
Thank you for the correction.
No worries.
I apologize, Mr. Cerberus.
Yeah, so each of them got over $4 billion in federal revenue, or at least the companies that they've invested in. And that's no chump change.
No.
You know, the top five got their federal contractor holdings got $12.5 billion in fiscal 2011.
This is nothing to shake a stick at. This insight is something that you'll definitely want to take a look at. Private equity active in federal market. It's a big of insight written by a defense finance analyst, SOPIN Shaw. Is there anything you want to leave us with, something that you want to make sure that we glean from this?
Well, you know, I think we've talked about the most important points already, but an interesting fact that doesn't come out necessarily in insight is that we only focused on private equity investments in which the company is 100% owned or majority owned by private equity firms. And it's definitely possible that these firms are investing in earlier stage contractors currently that aren't even captured by our list.
But potentially could be.
But yes, potentially
in the future,
could be. Exactly. So lots of exciting stuff going on in both private equity and government contracting. And the next couple of years should be interesting in terms of developments.
Well, I'm sure as we make our way through the remainder of the budget process, we'll have you in to talk more about defense and private equity and lots more that you have available currently on BGov.com.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
As do we. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, joined now by the authors of a Bloomberg Government study entitled Lease Prices for Federal and Natural Gas Land, Economics of Federal Oil and Gas Leases. In the hot seats now, economic analyst Jason Arvello and energy analyst Allison Williams. Thanks for joining me, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Didn't mean to cut you off. Thank you. The Bureau of Land Management has about 245 million acres of land, government-owned. About seven or just under 700 million, we'll call it, are what they're calling subsurface acres of mineral states. And I'm guessing this is what we're going to be talking about during this segment, correct?
Exactly.
So recently, I read that the U.S. could be disengaged from foreign oil by 2035, let's say, if all goes well, fingers crossed, in the next 10 years. I know there's some milestones along the way, but 2035 is the most recent number that I heard anyway. First off, Allison, I'm kind of wondering if that's a fair statement, and secondly, where are we with this oil and gas development at this point?
That's a great question. Right now, the majority of our oil comes from offshore drilling.
Right.
But increasingly, in the wake of the oil spill in 2010, a lot of focus has been put on onshore development.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start developing onshore oil resources, you're quickly going to be looking toward shale oil, or what some people are now calling tight oil. And those areas are primarily, I mean, they're located all over the country, but a big portion of that is going to be in the West on federal or beneath federal land.
Mm-hmm. Jason, as we're talking about money, with regard to this, you're talking about shale oil or flat oil,
tight oil,
value on something like this?
I mean, what we've seen through the lease data that we looked at was that developers are really going for oil. High world oil prices at about $80 a barrel right now really prompt developers to look for that crude, as opposed to natural gas, which is at decade lows at around $2 or $3 per MMBTU.
Every day we're hearing the price of oil up, down, up, down. Big political struggle as we go on. The president makes no bones about it. In fact, saying that America is well on its way to becoming oil self-sufficient. Just a couple of weeks ago, he said, and I quote, "For 2 years in a row, America has bought less oil from other countries than we produce here at home. For the first time in over a decade, we've done that." Fair statement to say?
That is definitely a fair statement. The question is, what's driving imports down? It's in part due to the fact that we've become much more efficient at using the oil that we consume. And so we use a little bit less of it. But we are increasing production in the U.S. The question is whether that's happening below federal land or below private land. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of discrepancy about where growth is actually occurring. What we found is that oil production offshore is definitely in decline, but onshore, on federal land, it's actually increasing.
So, and that's in the wake of the disasters that we've had in the Gulf of late, back in 2010, and some of the other minor ones as well.
That offshore trend is definitely driven by the offshore spill, but onshore, what we found in the study is that producers are becoming much more efficient at capturing and extracting oil out of less land, less federal land.
What are the quality control measures that are being placed on our oil brethren overseas, let's say? Are they using the same methods? And maybe this is something that you may or may not be able to answer, but if we're able to more effectively capture oil and make it a more efficient process, thus helping reduce costs, can we say the same that's happening overseas?
That's a great question, and it's a little unsure. The technology that we use is a combination of horizontal drilling and what's called hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Mm-hmm. And in combination, that allows us to get resources that were previously uneconomical to develop. Now, overseas, there are definitely those shale areas and oil and gas fields that are harder to extract, but the areas that have been well known for, like, the Middle East and Russia have been extracting resources that are much more surface and much more easy to extract. So the technology gains have been hugely beneficial for the U.S.
And just to add to what Allison was saying, I think we saw this argument kind of play out with the Keystone Pipeline, which was, you know, better that we develop these resources rather than someone else overseas, someone else who maybe doesn't have all the environmental, safety regulations that we have in place.
Right. So we're looking. There's a little bit of scare in this as well at the same time. As you hear oil prices bouncing up and down, I know personally when I'm listening to the radio and I hear the price of oil is going up, I go, I need to drive less. I need to do this. How much of that is playing into the fact that the oil prices could be reduced? Not only are we using our own resources on land, but we're now being more smart. Companies are building more energy-efficient equipment to burn the oil at the same time. Is that a fair statement as well?
Absolutely. So, you know, we look a lot of times at the production of mm-hmm. oil and natural gas, but it's really also the denominator that we need to look at, which is, you know, saving oil and natural gas, not using it to begin with. So that's a huge component in all of this.
You're listening to BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're speaking to Jason Arvelo and Allison Williams, authors of the BGov study, Lease Prices for Federal Oil and Natural Gas Land, Economics of Federal Oil and Gas Leases. So what role does the government play in this development?
It plays a very key role. About 20% of domestic production of natural gas comes from federal lands, and about 30% of domestic production of oil comes from those lands as well.
So a lot of work obviously went into putting this study together. I mean, you've identified winners, you've identified losers, some of the big players. What's unique about the analysis that you've done that kind of sets this apart from other studies out there?
So what we did was we compiled a data set of about 16,000 winning bids for federal land, and we looked at states that were located in the West. So if you're looking at a map driving home right now or thinking about driving home, keep your eyes on the road, but if you can mentally picture the U.S., it would be the 17 states south and to the west of North Dakota. And so what we did was we compiled this census, essentially, of all winning bids, and we looked at key trends, kind of what's happening in terms of lease activity.
Okay.
And the reason we looked in the west is largely because that's where the bulk of federal land exists. And one of the interesting things about federal land in the West is that as soon as the primary natural gas and oil reserves in the U.S. that are on private land start to be kind of tapped out, developers are going to have to move west. And as soon as they move west, they're going to have to look at federal land. That's pretty much all that's there.
Were there any trends that you were able to identify as you took a look at this?
Sure. So what we saw in the data was a tripling of lease prices from 2010 to 2011. It went from about $26 an acre to $90 an acre just in 1 year. And I think that kind of plays to what Allison was talking about before with fracking, and developers are simply able to extract much more out of any given acre of land. So they're willing to pay more upfront for that property.
How much of that depends on what may be underground, what's there, dependent on what they're actually digging for?
Right, and that's a great distinction. So we looked at lease activity, which by no means is a guarantee of finding anything beneath the ground. These are just the rights to explore the property. And, you know, to the extent that geologists are able to kind of better figure out where that valuable land is, I think we're seeing that uptick in the price as well.
So let's talk winners here. This is a space that obviously is going to grow. Who are the big players in the space right now?
So by and large, most of these federal land lessees are private firms, mom and pop shops, if you will, that most of us haven't heard of. But we do see really big public players taking part in this lease activity. For example, we saw ExxonMobil, Hess, Marathon Oil, KKR, private equity firm. They're all trying to tap into the federal government's property.
The study is called Lease Prices for Federal Oil and Natural Gas Land, Economics of Federal Oil and Gas Leases. Their names are Allison Williams and Jason Arvilla. Thank you very much for joining us. It's Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And with another recess right around the corner, thought it would be a pretty good idea to get up to speed with what Congress has to look forward to when they return in the month of July. For that preview, we turn to our congressional analyst, Mr. Lauren Duggan.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back. So let's talk appropriations.
Sure.
Long process.
Right.
What are the next steps right now? Where are we?
Well, the House and Senate are going to be gone next week, and then when they come back, they have a pretty full plate on appropriations. September 30th is the start of the next fiscal year. That's a while off, but there's only a, 5 or 6 weeks before then of real legislative business to get things done on that front. The House has already said they'll probably take up the defense appropriations bill. That's always a big one in terms of money. Sometimes the debate is short, but it's $519.2 billion for non-war funding, which is about half the discretionary pie.
That's walking
around.
It's
a pretty
money.
Big deal. and then they might also do a bill called the Financial Services General Government Bill. That one's the Treasury Department and a lot of the regulators that people know, SEC, the FCC, groups like that, that, you know, a lot of our business clients here at VGov really want to pay attention to.
Sure.
Because how much money they have may give an indication of how they're going to regulate, Money equals inspectors, equals people writing the rules that you have to follow, that sort of thing.
Makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. So it's not too busy when they return.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. We're actually going to have a four-week stretch in the House, which is one of the longer stretches we've had this year. So,
yeah. So not long ago, there was a hunger strike. U.S. Postal Service workers, there were like four or five, a handful of them, let's say, protesting the financial problems, the woes of the Postal Service and potential service changes and such. You know, we all kind of turned to Congress for assistance, and the Postal Service is looking for, hey, give us some guidance here. What's going on? What do you think they or what will they be doing with regard to the Postal Service?
Majority Leader Eric Cantor said it's his hope in July to bring up a bill dealing with postal issues. It's
right.
One that's come out of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And there probably aren't a lot of easy answers here. The Postal Service has a lot of liabilities that have built up over time, including payments that have to go into a retirement fund. And Congress is trying to figure out a way to help them solve that problem, but also get on a firmer financial footing going forward. You know, questions like, do we shift to five-day mail, get rid of Saturday delivery, which raises a lot of questions
sure.
in different areas,
sure.
prescription drug deliveries, other things like do we shut down post offices, do we reduce the number, what system do we put into place to make those decisions, because, often closing a post office can mean a lot to a small community or rural community. People want to fight to stop that. So one of the ideas is, do we create a commission to help us wade through these different cost-cutting proposals and find the right one, the way we do for military bases? We took that out of the hands of Congress, who has constituents, and put it in an independent panel that makes recommendations. So there could be an approach like that
taken. I was reading somewhere there are a couple of thousand rural routes that could be canceled that are potentially on the block, dependent on what happens.
Right. I'm sure there's a lot of different approaches that you could take, and the deeper the problem gets, the more drastic it has to become. But there's also questions such as, do you let the Postal Service do different things to raise money on their own, Do we allow deliveries of alcohol? That's been one of the things out there, Interesting ideas. Time will tell.
That there is a good one. Any updates from the farm bill front?
Well, the Senate passed its bill this month, so they've laid down their marker where they want to take things. The House was scheduled to have a markup before the break on its version of it, the House Agriculture Committee. That was postponed until they come back, and it'll be interesting to see if they go forward with that and what approach their bill takes. The longer they go into the year without laying down their version of it, bringing it to the House floor, the greater the chances maybe they won't resolve this by September 30th, which is also the deadline for that.
Right.
But they could always extend the current law for a while if they wanted to. And, it'll be an interesting debate to see what pans out there.
Having been a watcher of the Hill for quite some time, do you feel as though they'll be focused when they return?
In July? I think July could be a fairly productive month. There'll be a lot of votes. They have a lot of issues they want to get to. September, then attention starts shifting towards the campaign. The schedule's a little more hectic then with breaks for holidays and things like that. So July might be one of the more productive months before the end of the year when things get really interesting.
So back in August of 2011, Gibson Guitars, their factory in Tennessee, was raided.
Right.
One of many times their factory has been raided. Because of some illegally sourced wood. Now, artists are coming out on both sides of this argument saying, hey, it's okay. No, it's not okay. People like Dave Matthews and various others are poking their heads up. This has brought about the Lacey Act. What's going on with this? I found this extremely interesting.
Well, there's some provision that was added to the law a few years ago that about these imports of illegally sourced wood, and people are supporting legislation that they say would stop the ability of some federal regulators to seize private property, go in and take the wood. That was at Gibson Guitars, for example, and this has to do with, where is this wood coming from?
Sure.
And it is dividing members of the musical community. You have some people saying, I support this legislation because we need the guitars, we need the wood, and other musicians saying we should get the wood in an environmentally sustainable way. So what this bill would do is, make changes to the law. Some people say the changes are too drastic. Others say they're exactly what you need to protect companies like Gibson Guitars going forward.
So, good stuff coming up on the Hill in July.
Right.
Thank you, Lauren, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Congressional analyst for Bloomberg Government. His name is Lauren Duggan. Look for his writings as well on Congress Tracker on Bloomberg Government. Good look ahead at the day, available there at BGov.com. Thanks again to Allison Williams and Jason Arvello, authors of the BGov study, Lease Prices for Federal Oil and Natural Gas Land. Soap and Shaw's BGov Insight, Private Equity in Federal Market, is also available for download at BGov.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Bloomberg Gov for show updates. Follow me at Alan L. Scott. We'll get together again next Thursday, 11 a.m. Plenty to say about the business implications of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.
It happened September 11th.
Our nation's capital.
The heart of America's defenses.
It changed America forever.
And it united America.
It's time to give future generations a place to learn what happened.
Help us build the Pentagon Memorial Visitor Education Center.
Please make an online contribution at www.pentagonmemorial.org.
Live music, health screenings, food and fitness demos, all at Community Day 2012 and all free. Join the Federal City Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, on Saturday, August 11th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Arc in Southeast Washington, D.C. The annual event is set to engage and foster health, education, and political awareness. For more information on Community Day 2012, visit thefcacdst.org.